All right.
Okay.
Oh, now it's asking this. Why is it asking this?
Otherwise, we'll just go and talk to meditation.
I'm just going for it.
Huh?
No, go for it.
I mean, I can wait. But
nope,
I
go.
Can you talk a little bit more?
Yeah, no, please go ahead.
Okay.
I'll figure it out now.
Okay, so we just do very simple mindful meditation and try to then relax the mind and see where the mind is going spontaneously. That's all. So this is like, it's just assessment. Yeah, like first look. When we just sit without any specific purpose, kind of, you know, generating bodhicitta or thinking about samsara or whatever, by just basically letting the mind be by doing first a little bit of mindfulness meditation. Okay? So, okay, so you keep your back straight. You withdraw the mind by either having your eyes downcast, or you can lightly close them, whatever feels more comfortable. Try to completely relax and maybe make a strong determination not to move, because if pain comes up, it's actually quite good. Try to use that to see what the mind is doing when pain comes up. It's also very important actually to have a mind first that appreciates. Like, probably on one level we do understand that we are sick and that we are patients, because otherwise we would not be here. We would be out there having fun. The weather is beautiful. Could have gone on a boat, swimming, lying in bed, shopping. All those activities are more pleasant than sitting here and trying to listen, think, and meditate. But probably on one level, we do know. We have made that step. It's just not deep enough. So try to really appreciate that fact. Having the opportunity to be here, having contact to teachers, and I don't mean me by this, I mean teachers like Geshe-la, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Dzogchen Rinpoche, Zorin Nyesten Dalai Lama. Having contact to beings who have realizations in their minds, who have actualized the teachings. That is so rare and so precious. If you do know any of those teachers, just see how the mind spontaneously opens. Maybe just invoke his holiness to Dalai Lama. Just visualizing, imagining, immediately be relaxed. They're here to teach us. We have contact to them. We have a mind that is able to understand and from time to time do make effort. So it's important that we start to understand this so that we can appreciate the present situation. Grateful, humble, appreciative. So rare and so precious. So then as main focus, we can take our breath, just knowing that you're breathing in when you're breathing in, knowing that you're breathing out when you're breathing out. So that's quite a simple activity, but then just observe how difficult this is to do. Let the breath breathe itself, don't do any breathing exercises, just be natural. Same as with the mind, let thoughts arise, try to look at them, what content, what are we thinking about? Then come back through your breath until the next thought arises. In order to see how we are, you have to really first allow the mind to do whatever it wants to do. Try to just be the observer. See what the body is doing, see what the mind is doing. But have as main focal object your breath. Maybe try to recognize what the mind does to the, with the outside conditions, how the mind reacts to outside conditions, sounds, maybe smells from the kitchen. There's a cool breeze. It's hot. How does the mind react to those conditions? Does it stay stable in the breath, or does it react with like or dislike without us wanting it? This is what we're trying to see here. Hot, how does the mind react to the heat? Allow the mind to do what it wants to do, allow it to think what it wants to think. Right, and just text it, so we all know that, you know, there's no point to text, but if you want to have another human resource in our next life, important to have Richard's thoughts at the time of death. Actually, as a spiritual practitioner, it's very important to have Richard's thoughts all the time. But just look, you know, spontaneously we sat for maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes. Just look, how many of the thoughts we have for Richard? There was no big pain in the body. Sure, it's a little bit hot. You might be hungry. But the suffering at the time of death might be much more intense. If our mind will not be virtuous, even under relaxed conditions, it's a bit of an illusion to think that it will be virtuous at the time of death. Just think, how many of the thoughts that you had in the last 15 minutes were concerned about your happiness? And how many thoughts that you had in the last 15 minutes were spontaneously concerned with the happiness of others? And others, I don't mean own children, own parents. I mean all others. Not to make you feel guilty, it's not to judge. It's just to see where our mind goes spontaneously. And what is a virtuous mind? A virtuous mind is a mind that is open, relaxed, has space, peaceful, and is concerned about the happiness of somebody that you're not attached to. The mind that is as vast as the ocean, vast as the sky. Maybe just see the difference by ending the meditation, which is think, you know, we make the mind very big by thinking there are so many beings in this universe. Try to grasp that many numberless beings in this universe. You don't have to be able to touch them all individually. Just an idea, a thought that we try to taste. Numberless sentient beings. Before, the thought was circling around one sentient being, which is me, and now we change to numberless sentient beings. Try to see if there's any difference. And then we just generate the wish of loving kindness, coordinate with grace. With all those beings of happiness and the causes of happiness. gonna go and check. I just got my mistake here. To wish for those numberless sentient beings to have happiness, not the responsibility that you have to do something about it. Just to wish to act. You don't have the skills to help them. So nobody's asking you to do that. You're just generating the wish. And then with the wish firmly established in the mind, skillful action will naturally follow. Wouldn't it be good? They all have happiness and the causes of happiness. So what is our sickness? Maybe it's just me. Maybe it's just me who's always circling around myself. You know, like I have the spontaneous thought. Last week I had this dressing on the salad. It wasn't so good. So maybe I should go to the kitchen and just get some olive oil as I usually do. That was the first thought that came after the first of breath, of course, you know, and then it put on the plate. Always me, yeah? Like that. I'm going to tomorrow, what should I do tomorrow? Okay. Maybe it's just me, maybe it's like that. Just me. If it would be just me, I'd be very relieved. And I'd be, okay, at least those guys are okay.
It's just me.
Yeah. And how does that mind feel? Does it feel like a healthy mind, like a good mind? We don't feel it unless we compare it, we put the other mind next to it. The other mind, you think, just that thought, you know. Me is like very small, it's very tight, it's very, it doesn't have a good flavor kind of, it's not like something that's been chewed on for too long. Doesn't have any energy, doesn't have much, we should have interest for our own happiness, but this is just exaggerated self-concern, you know. This is the self-cherishing, which still hasn't understood that just circling around myself is not going to do the trick. And definitely doesn't understand that this spontaneous circling around myself can throw me into a lower state after time of death. And the sickness is kind of having it, not wanting to having it, but still having it. That's kind of the sickness, you know, kind of. Intellectually we understand that it's not a good thing, but there's no, yeah. We haven't made enough steps yet towards to get rid of it, because we haven't understood, I think, how serious this is. Because we see, okay, I'm self-cherishing in the meditation, but we don't see the results of that. And we don't see that at the time of death, that mind will do exactly the same thing, circling around myself. If it can't go spontaneously into a state of thinking about the happiness of others while I'm more or less comfortable, then for sure it won't do that at the time of death. Okay. What did you think? Oh, microphone.
My first thought was like you, I went to lunch.
Yeah, right.
And you know, it was about, well, reading and all the, you know, very good. But what I noticed particularly was how this time, how much while I'm watching the drug, that my other senses are flying everywhere,
yeah.
out the window, down the
yeah.
hall, up and,
yeah.
And the physical
mm.
body, how it's noticing this and that, and it's like I was, it felt like I was like sitting in the middle of a monkey cage.
Yeah, yeah.
With all these senses going
yeah.
out, the ear sense, and,
mm.
and like since my eyes were shut, I was still hearing things outside, and I would go out visually,
right.
even to
yeah.
try to pull that picture.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Grading
yeah.
and amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
yeah. And then living the image, we want to live the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
And then we start to create our own personal drama, so yeah, by doing that, by interpreting in a certain way.
But then I also didn't feel like you had said at the beginning, just breathe, let your body breathe.
Uh-huh.
And when I watch my breath, it always seems like I, you know, it's really hard for me to imagine it's just playing by itself. I don't know
yeah.
if that's, it doesn't seem like it's doing.
We're too focused on it. This is why it's very important, really, you know, watching the breath is not to make you peaceful, because you see, if you start watching the breath with this idea that it should make you peaceful, then you want to have peace right now. So then you start using the breath to make the mind peaceful, but that's not the point. We have to learn to let the breath ease itself, not my breath. Okay. Why one does like mindfulness, why one meditates anyway, is to see the nature of our existence as being unsubstantial, insecure, like impermanent, yeah. actually in the nature of suffering, and there's no owner. Nobody owns the suffering, nobody owns the instability, nobody owns the happiness. Yeah. This is what we're supposed to see. By seeing that, then peace will come. But as long as we want peace first, and then maybe we'll feel it won't work. Yeah. You see, like this is why the meditation, that's what meditation is for, is to see the suffering. Is to see that we are sick, is to see how uncontrolled the mind goes out. How a little bit of heat makes us feel uncomfortable. How the breeze, you know, did you notice that breeze comes? It's almost as you see hands kind of trying to catch that breeze, kind of wanting it to be here and touch my body so it will cool me down. Did you notice something like that? No? Yeah, everybody notices something different. Yeah, it's very much just dependent on the timing. When we began, you said the pain is good. Can you tell us why it's good? Yeah, it would have been good to see if pain arises, where do the thoughts go? What does the mind do? Did anybody have pain and observe that? And then what happened? How much concern for the happiness of others do we still have in our mind when there's pain in the body? How much? Zero. Yeah. So this is why, you see also why maybe, because we're so concerned with being comfortable and happy in this life, like the short-term happiness, that we completely forget that the last moment of this life will determine where we are going to be, where we're going to be in our next life. And however much comfort we have, that's not going to help. However much money we have, that's not going to help. But how we are able to keep the mind on a virtuous thought, this will help. And we have to really start to see the patient, you know, where is our sickness. Is as long as everything goes more or less okay, we're pretty relaxed and open and concerned about others. But the moment pain comes, and at the time of death, there might be pain, terrible pain, yeah. then it's just me, I. Yeah. And it's a habit. It feels very natural, and we think this is our nature. It's just a habit. We have the practice until now was how to make this mind happy, this eye happy. So of course that's what we do because the mind is trained to do that. But while we are still alive now, by seeing this can be very dangerous at the time of death. I've heard people say what really bad cancer, who were very good practitioners, that they tried to do Tonglen when they were full of pain. It was absolutely impossible. It was impossible. Because it's not, the mind is not trained enough to do that. Or, for example, you know, they say at the time of death, taking refuge will be the most important thing.
How many people do you think, I on purpose, I didn't say anything, that before the meditation you should take refuge. How many of you took refuge? Yeah? So this is, you know, this is why it's also difficult to do all those things, because we don't do them in the right way. The more your mind is relaxed and clear, the more you are in control and you are able to do whatever you want the mind to do. But the more the mind is not peaceful and not relaxed, the more it goes all over the place. So taking refuge can be a great way of kind of, you know, focusing, thinking. This is why also, did you notice, you think about the Dalai Lama? What happened? You smile, you relax. The moment there's a spontaneous smile on your face, you're in control. Yeah, that's the thing. You're in control. Same thing, maybe you notice that you start to think of all those sentient beings. May they have happiness. May they be well. What happens? Just the thought, you know. Numberless sentient beings. What happens? Did you notice something? What? Microphone. Peter. I'm not sure if you read
it. That's as far as
as soon as you said non-Buddhist, it was almost like a little free song went through me. I started getting more nervous and agitated.
Uh-huh.
And that was the first reaction. And then I started thinking in a more compassionate way towards them. But at first, I have to say, to be honest with you, it was kind of like almost a nervousness to people that weren't following the Buddhist path.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, the compassion came out from that point.
Yeah. I think, you know, why it is so difficult to think for us about numberless sentient beings, because we're so arrogant thinking we can make a difference. And we put that responsibility upon our shoulders. We don't see that. If you really want to help, like a real bodhisattva, you have to become a bodhisattva first. Yeah? Otherwise, if we try to do the activities of a bodhisattva with non-bodhisattva mind, of course you burn out. Of course it frightens us, of course it makes us nervous, because we don't have the skills. Yeah? So it's okay just to, at the beginning, just to meditate. You know, many people say, oh, but that's just fake, and you know, it's just fake in reality and this and that. It's not really. I mean, if you're out there and you can do something, you should definitely do it. Yeah? But you see, if you do train the mind first on your cushion, and because then the mind will want to engage in a positive way. And it will be much easier. Yeah. This is why His Holiness says, this is what many Westerners can't understand. His Holiness says, just to meditate on love, like this thought, may all beings be happy, may they all be free from suffering. He said, it's much better than to feed 300 people. This we can't understand. How can that be, sitting on your cushion, not being active, you know, be better, but not just sitting there, but generating love? Because the same way as our mind now is so spontaneously self-concerned, the same way it can be trained to be spontaneously trained to be concerned about the happiness of others. And in the same way, as it spontaneously works for my own comfort and my happiness when I go to the table, I look for the food I like. I don't have to remind myself, say, oh, now you have to be careful, you have to take the food that you like. This comes without thinking. Yeah? Automatic. Easy. So that mind is trained. But the same way the mind can be trained, but this will take a long time, to be concerned with the happiness of others. So the same way as my mind is happy working for my own happiness, it will be happy working for the happiness of others. But we have to train that mind first, so we have to start in small steps. By also then, you know, creating those other attitudes. So the first attitude is, of course, seeing ourselves as a patient. We're sick. Why? Because we have an uncontrolled mind. We can't say to tell them, now stay on the grill. So, I'm going, goodbye. You know? This is what our mind is doing. You can tell me whatever you want. And actually, this seems to be another contradiction. You have to allow the mind to do what it wants to do at the beginning. Otherwise you freak out. But you have to be mindful of what you're doing. By allowing the mind to do what it wants to do, you start to see that it's, you know, that it's not stable, that is suffering, and there is no owner at the end. It's only by allowing the mind to do what it wants to do, but by being mindful behind it, that it will become peaceful. You can't force your mind to be loving and compassionate for the living. You have to give the mind the right thought, so then it can be naturally loving and compassionate. You can't just sit and say, stop being angry. That doesn't work. You have to think about the disadvantage of being angry, so the mind, you know, so then the fact of wisdom can start to operate, and then it understands, oh yeah, it's dangerous. And then you still will not stop because, you know, the habits are still there, so that's okay. It's good to understand that it takes a long time. So, Dharma is like a cure, so it's like, the Dharma is the medicine, get rid of patients. The Dharma is the medicine, and your diligent practice is the cure. So of course, if you expect big results with not taking the medicine properly and not doing the exercises that you're supposed to do, nobody would be surprised if the cure is not working. You know, if you have a physical pain in the body, you go to see the physiotherapist. Yeah, they give you a certain exercise. You understand the exercise. You can even do it properly. But you wouldn't go back the next day saying, oh, well, I did it 3 times. It still doesn't work. And you would actually understand that the pain gets worse at the beginning when you start to do the exercise. You do the exercise, the pain gets worse, you're not going to complain. You're actually quite happy to see that it's working. But when we start meditating and we get worse, we think we get worse. We're not getting worse. We're just seeing how we are. We think we're doing something wrong. We don't. We're just working. And the mind, we start to change habits. And the mind rebels against that. It doesn't like it. Yeah? And the cure is always uncomfortable. So we are sick. The Dharma is the medicine. Your diligent practice is the cure. Cures are uncomfortable. Our problem is we want a pleasant cure. Not going to work. Then the other attitudes are, so the patient, Dharma is the medicine, your diligent practice is the cure. Then seeing all teachers as the Tathagata, or sometimes you read it a little bit differently. Sometimes it's like seeing all the Buddhas as one, but also seeing all teachers as the Buddha. That's a tricky one, because you have to check that. You shouldn't do that blindly. Yeah, but once you have accepted somebody as a teacher, then if you can see that person is the Buddha, then they can bless you as a Buddha can bless you. Yeah. So that's important. Because then, you see, the more you trust your doctor, like it's kind of seeing the Buddha or the teacher as your doctor, I forgot that one. Yeah, that comes after the patient. So it's like seeing yourself as a patient, knowing that you can't help yourself, basically. That makes you very humble. And this for us Western is very difficult. You know, so many people come and say, do I really need a teacher? For everything that we want to learn, we need a teacher, you know. If nobody would have taught us how to walk, we'd still be crawling on the ground. We're so arrogant and so proud. Do I really need a teacher to attain enlightenment? It's like, come on! You see, everybody wants to be free of suffering. Everybody wants to be happy. If the wish alone would be okay, we would all be enlightened. Of course you need a teacher. Listen, samsara is a very dangerous jungle. Our mind is is creating that dangerous jungle. If we want to find the way out, we need a guide. Otherwise, we would be liberated long ago. We've been existing since beginningless time. Yeah? So you need to trust your doctor. The more you trust your doctor, the more, if there's problems on the path, you continue. And this doctor also needs to inspire you. So this doctor needs to be free from sickness. If the doctor has the same sickness and doesn't do the cure, then that means, you know, then it goes. How can that be a doctor? That means he doesn't believe in the cure himself. He doesn't have any faith that the cure works. Yeah. If he does the same, constantly does the same thing. Now you go to a doctor, we have lung cancer from smoking, and he smokes, right? That wouldn't be very inspiring, would it? So like this. So those are the ones, those teachers who try to see as the Buddha. And then the sixth one is to see, to have a wish that the Buddha Dharma remains for a long time. Because we can start to see that it works.
Yeah.
Because even if it works slow, but I think nobody who practices and comes to the teaching, does the meditation for 2 or 3 years, nobody says nothing has changed. We have moments when we do feel worse, that's true. Moments. But nobody can say nothing has changed. I don't have less suffering. Nobody. Yeah. So we start to see that it works, so we have to wish that other beings can enjoy that as well. You know, same way, when you have a certain sickness, you find some kind of cure, you're not completely cured yet, but you see that it helps. Somebody else describes the same symptoms to you, what do? Spontaneously. You tell them what to do, and start accepting sometimes, because, you know, there's so many conflicting views here. The nice thing about Buddhism is, like, essence-wise, it's always the same. There is suffering, there's causes of suffering, it's possible to get rid of the suffering and how. Essence is always the same, that isn't it? So then we have this wish that the Buddha Dharma stays along for a long time. So if that wish is there, what's the best way of making the Buddha Dharma stay for a long time? To go and convert everybody and force them to become the Buddha?
Mm-hmm.
What's the best way of making the Buddha Dharma stay for a long time? Exactly. We know that if we want this to be a benefit to many sentient beings, the best way is to practice and put it into daily life as much as we can without hating ourselves when we fail.
Okay.
So to find this balance between listening to the teachings, thinking about them, meditating on them, and then trying it out there. And if you fail out there, don't say the teachings didn't work, just come back and practice more. We want results too quickly, that's why we're doing that. So why? We talk about that this afternoon. We talk about how to practice in the right order. The Bodhisattva practice. So, did you get those 6 attitudes? They're coming. Did you get those 6 attitudes? Seeing ourselves as the patient. If we don't see ourselves as the patient, we don't make the step towards the cure. We don't engage in the cure. Then we look at the cure and say, oh, it sounds very interesting, very nice. You know? But there seems to be no need. If we don't see ourselves as what we have, it's dangerous because it can throw us into the lower state. It's not dangerous for this life so much. But it's dangerous for next life. Yeah? So seeing ourselves as a patient, seeing the Buddha as the doctor, seeing the Dharma as the medicine that we have to swallow, seeing our practice, our diligent practice as the cure, seeing all teachers as the actual Tathagata, then we can get inspired, and not me, yeah, this is, I have to make that very clear, I'm not a teacher, so because I don't have the qualities of a teacher, and then see, having the wish that the Buddha Dharma stays around for a long time, that will also make it easier. That's a, you know, how to benefit others with this wish so that the Buddha Dharma stays for a long time, with this wish for me to practice properly. That's the best way to benefit others. Best way. Seeing the Buddha, seeing the Dharma as the medicine. Okay. So I think lunch is ready. So we can offer the food. So again, you think about, don't think, oh, I wonder what is there. You visualize what is there. The most exquisite food that you can think about can be whatever you like. Can be chocolate, can be healthy food, can be burritos, can be pizza, can be spaghetti, can be, maybe not, I'm not sure. But anything, anyway, everything that you think is delicious, exquisite, magnificent, we try to develop one taste, we try to kind of offer whatever we think is beautiful without the thought, oh, but it's not healthy. Okay, we transform, we use our attachment. You know, we give away whatever we think is worthy of being given away. Whatever we think as spontaneously as delicious, beautiful, exquisite. And we imagine oceans and oceans and oceans and oceans of it. So we open up the mind again. We make it boundless. We make it like an ocean. And then we think of all the beings who produce this food, and all the other beings maybe who don't have such good karma as us, we can just go there and eat. We don't have to put any effort into getting the food. It comes from practicing generosity, feeding others. So we rejoice in that first. And we know that by offering the food to all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, again, one creates a tremendous amount of merit. Unbelievable amount of merit, as one of the says. Unbelievable. Inconceivable. And immediately we give away that merit, mentally, to all the beings who don't know how to offer the food, to all the beings who suffer now from not having offered food, so that they can get the merit and be liberated from their suffering. We see the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, receiving the food in form of nectar. They're very pleased and send back showers of light rays, which bless us, inspire us, so that we can practice tirelessly. The verse of offering, you can chant it with me. It means Guru is Buddha, Guru is Dharma, Guru is Dharma. Guru is Buddha, Guru is Dharma, Guru is Sangha. Also Guru is the originator of openness and happiness. To all Gurus, I make these offerings. So you think you make these offerings, just that thought. I make these offerings to all holy objects. So the Gurus, the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, the statues, the scriptures, representations of Buddhas like Shankars, Dasas, and Stupas. See how this is received by all the holy objects. That's why it creates inconceivable merit, because there's inconceivable holy objects. And they receive it and send back and shine it like this. Blessings as well, and are immediately liberated from their suffering. So we can eat the food without being feeling guilty. And this sounds very hypocritical at the beginning, but it really happens. If you continue to do that, it really happens. You don't feel guilty anymore, and guilt is no good anyway. It doesn't feed the master. It just makes you sick. And it, you know, produces a mind who's not content. No point in your field. No point abstaining from eating the food, doesn't feed the master to do it. But offering it like that, and then, you know, dedicating all the merit immediately to the well-being body. So we can go further, even we see that they are receiving Buddha help, we're just receiving the food. Okay? That's a better deal. And we meet again at 1 o'clock, so then you have an hour in the quarter. Please enjoy the food. Just go ahead.